CNN senior legal analyst and bestselling author Ellie Honig explores America's two-tier justice system, explaining how the rich, the famous, and the powerful, including most notoriously Donald Trump, manipulate the legal system to escape justice and get away with vast misdeeds. His new book is Untouchable: How Powerful People Get Away With It. How does he get away with it? That question, more than any other, vexes observers of and participants in the American criminal justice process. And how do powerful people weaponize their wealth, political power, and fame to beat the system? And how can prosecutors fight back? All of this addressed in the new book, Untouchable: How Powerful People Get Away With It. It is published by Harper, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Ellie Honig back to the roundtable. Thank you very much for being with us.
Joe, thanks for having me. One thing I would note about this is it's always timely, or perhaps it's timeless. I mean, even just in the last 24, 48 hours, we've seen new developments that play directly into some of the original reporting and scoops that I have in this book about Donald Trump being under investigation for hush money, and I'm sure we'll get into this. But it was the way that this book came about, I'll just tell you, is, and you referenced this, I had done my first book for Harper, and they were pleased, and they said, what do you want to do next? And I said, I don't really know. And they said, well, what question do you get asked? You're working in the media. And I said, oh, that's easy. How does he get away with it? And they said, there you go. That's your next book. And this is the end result of that.
Yeah. And the he is almost always Donald Trump, yes?
Well, I wouldn't say almost always, but I would say the most common he is Donald Trump. But this book ranges all over the landscape of American power, celebrity, and wealth, from people like Harvey Weinstein, Jeffrey Epstein, Bill Cosby, various other politicians, governors, members of Congress, powerful titans of finance, CEOs. So there's a lot that I cover in the book. But yes, I mean, Trump, of course, is the most frequent subject of
right.
questioning.
So you just mentioned a whole list of people. So how different is Trump than those other people? Are they all similar cases, or is this one especially different?
Well, there are similarities, but Trump for sure is a unique figure when it comes to examining our justice system and the advantages held by powerful people for two reasons. One, he has enormous political power, which in some ways is different than just sort of ordinary celebrity power that a Bill Cosby, let's say, might have. But second of all, he was the president, and there are all sorts of unique rules and carve-outs that favor especially a president, or in some instances, a former president. So Trump is really a unique historical, I think, challenge to some of these systems that we have in place in our criminal justice process.
So why are these systems so favorable to people like Donald Trump and other rich, powerful people?
Yeah, so I really look at three main factors that I think coalesce in this book. One is our laws, our rules, our policies themselves, several of which absolutely on their face favor the powerful, and I can give you some examples of that. Second of which is many people who are powerful bosses are savvy people who've succeeded in their fields, whether business or entertainment or politics, and they understand either consciously or sort of instinctively how best to manipulate that system and to leverage it. And third, I'm a former prosecutor. I was a federal and state prosecutor for 14 years. I tend to be pro-prosecutor, but I'm quite critical in this book of some of the tactics and failures by various prosecutors to really hold powerful people to justice.
So let's use one of the news-making elements of this book, which is days before Donald Trump, then president, left the White House, federal prosecutors in New York discussed whether to potentially charge Trump with campaign finance crimes once he was out of office. And that's according to your book. Why wait?
Yeah. Well, so this is actually a perfect example, and this is original reporting in my book, a perfect example of all three of those factors coming together. While Donald Trump was in office, the Southern District of New York, my former office, I should say, federal prosecutors, a famously aggressive prosecutor's office, took on this hush money investigation. Now, because of a longstanding DOJ policy, a written policy, they could not indict Donald Trump while he was president. So they set about doing the case, and they were preparing to indict Michael Cohen. In the course of that, in drafting the indictment of Michael Cohen, they felt like they had powerful proof as to Donald Trump as well. And so they wanted to put that proof in Michael Cohen's indictment, calling Donald Trump what eventually became famously Individual One, although the Southern District wanted to call him other things. They considered calling him Co-Conspirator One, although they ultimately did not do that. But the bosses down in D.C. got wind of this, and they said, absolutely not. We are not including all this information on Donald Trump. And in fairness, their argument was he's not being indicted, and so we don't lay out damning information about people who were not indicting. The Southern District pushed back, and I detail the sort of power struggle that happened inside DOJ. But needless to say, DOJ prevailed. And the indictment that came out of Michael Cohen is essentially sanitized as to Donald Trump. Now, fast forward. It's January 2021. Trump is leaving office. Now that protection that guards him while he's sitting president is running out. And I report for the first time in this book that prosecutors in the Southern District sat down and said, all right, what are we going to do? We're going to indict him. We can indict him now. Are we going to? And they ultimately, of course, decided not to. And what I think is really interesting in the book is it's not because they felt the evidence wasn't there. Opinions varied a bit within the team. Some felt it was borderline but chargeable as to Trump. Others felt like it was absolutely a makeable case as to Trump and a strong case. But ultimately, the SDNY looked at it and said, considering all the balance of factors, the political explosiveness of indicting a former president, the fact that he has all these other potential criminal issues, January 6th, Mueller obstruction, they ultimately decided to give it a pass. And as a result, Donald Trump has never been charged with that. In fact, the only person who's been charged as of this moment with the hush money scheme is Michael Cohen, who was essentially a bag man in that scheme. He wrote a couple checks. He got reimbursed. He was guilty. He pled guilty to it. But to me, it's an absolute injustice that only Michael Cohen ever got charged, never mind Donald Trump or any of the other people who were involved.
So the news this week is the prosecutors are to present a grand jury with evidence about hush money payments to Donald Trump,
yep,
by Donald Trump, to Stormy Daniels during the 2016 election campaign. Alvin Bragg, the Manhattan District Attorney in New York, is going to revive this investigation. Mm-hmm. Why is that happening now?
I don't have a good answer as to why. It's actually sort of curious that it's happening now, because this conduct goes back to 2016. I mean, we're 6.5 years beyond this. He's going to actually have to deal with potential statute of limitations issues, meaning the amount of time you have to indict a case. But there arguably were some financial aspects of this that carried into the 5-year period. I'm not sure why, other than I know Alvin Bragg. I'm a friend of his. He's a friend of mine. I'm a friend of his. We worked together at the Southern District of New York in our prior jobs. I have to assume it's because he has new evidence that he believes, or sufficient evidence. And like I said, the feds believe they did have sufficient evidence. They just chose not to for other reasons. The other thing that is at play here is Michael Cohen, because the Southern District of New York rejected Michael Cohen. That's a public record. They wrote a letter to the judge saying, while he told us some information, we don't believe he was fully forthcoming, and therefore we're not going to use him as a witness. It may be that the DA, Alvin Bragg, has reached a different conclusion on Michael Cohen and is willing to stake a case on Michael Cohen. Not an easy thing to do, but prosecutors do build cases on cooperating witnesses all the time. I did it plenty of times with people far worse than Michael Cohen. I should add, Michael Cohen's also a friend of mine as well. So, we will see. It will be really interesting to see. They're presenting this case to a grand jury. The vast majority of cases that go to grand juries result in indictment. But then again, the vast majority of the rules don't apply to Donald Trump.
Why don't they apply to Donald Trump? Why do they not apply to other powerful people?
Oh, well, that's the whole book. I gave an example, but I'll give you another example of how powerful people are really adept
well, in
at
the
manipulating.
Sense of, I mean, like, this just goes into the timing issue, right? I mean, like,
yeah.
So it seems that if there's a will, but it also seems like a lot of times the question of, yes, it's probably illegal, but we don't have enough. And then you just wonder, well, whatever would be enough?
Right. Well, that's an interesting question for prosecutors. And one of the things that I note in the book is it is official, formal DOJ policy. It's this document called the U.S. Attorney. It used to be called the U.S. Attorney's Manual. Now it's called the Justice Manual. It's public. It's online. And it is binding on all federal prosecutors across the country. That document specifically says if your subject is a political player, is an elected official, is a person who is likely to draw media attention, then your case has to go up to higher and higher levels of supervisory review and approval. And as a practical matter, what that means is it's harder, the bar is higher to charge a powerful person than an ordinary person. I give several examples, both from the news and my own experience in the book. I'll give you a quick sort of summary of one of them. I had a case, a low-level case, where we had a borderline charge involving a well-known baseball player, a professional baseball player who was fairly well-known, not necessarily a household name, but famous. And ordinarily, if this guy couldn't play baseball and he was just a normal guy, I would have made that decision entirely by myself as I was a third or fourth or fifth year prosecutor at the time. However, because this involved a guy who would have been, if he had been charged, would have been front page of newspapers, I had to run it up the chain and up the chain and up the chain. And so that case got way more scrutiny because he was a famous person. And I will tell you, we did not end up charging that case. It's part of the reason I don't disclose his name. I was probably leaning against charging it, but powerful people just get more review, more scrutiny. And just as a mathematical issue, it's just that much harder to get that many more people to sign on to a case.
You talk in the book about juries and that it can be difficult to get a conviction when you are talking about a famous or powerful person. Why do we know why that's the case, and what can be done in your job to avoid that?
Yeah. Well, so I explore this in the book. And the first thing that I say is jury service is really scary for the people who serve on the jury, even in a routine case. You know, we like to think of juries as these sort of monoliths, these just, you know, entities. But really, they're just 12 human beings. I've chosen many, many juries, and you're looking at these people thinking, boy, they're just normal people who get thrown together, and all they want to do is get a verdict and go home. It's scary. They're in court. There's potentially, you know, heated arguments. There's a judge giving you instructions. And now imagine if the person on trial is famous, is powerful. What are the fears? First of all, there's media coverage. That can be intimidating to a jury. In some cases, and I talk about mafia cases I did, they're afraid of actual physical retribution. That's fairly rare. Juries are also afraid of the consequences of their verdicts, and actually can work both ways. If you look at Harvey Weinstein, for example, I think it's logical to assume that, look, the evidence was overwhelming as to Harvey Weinstein, but I think jurors quite reasonably could have been thinking, boy, if we don't convict him, we're going to be chastised, right? We let this horrible sexual predator off. But if you're thinking about Donald Trump in particular, I mean, yes, he's enormously unpopular. He's also enormously popular at the same time. We saw what people did on January 6th when they felt Trump had been wrong. We've heard Donald Trump and others, including Senator Lindsey Graham, essentially explicitly call on people to take to the streets if Donald Trump is ever indicted. And so you have to put yourself in a position of one of those jurors. Are they going to be thinking in the back of their heads, gee, if we convict him and send him to prison, that's what that means, we could have unrest, people could get hurt, we might be attacked in the media. And so I think that's a real, I take a real humanistic view of juries. I've chosen enough juries and looked at enough jurors to know that they are human beings subject to the same frailties as anybody else.
You say in the book, we like to believe the axiom, nobody is above the law, but you say we need to add a qualifier, except the president. It seems like through history, Nixon and beyond, we've been playing with this question.
Yeah. You know, people sometimes say DOJ cannot indict the sitting president. That's actually not quite right. I do a historical dive here that I think is fascinating if you're interested in history. It's not that they can't. It's that we don't really know, but DOJ has long decided that they don't want to try. In 1973, as the Watergate scandal was exploding, DOJ researched the issue and they issued this memo that actually was inspired by Spiro Agnew, the vice president, who was involved in a separate bribery scheme. And they concluded that, yes, you can. Bad news for Spiro Agnew. Yes, you can indict a sitting vice president, but no, you cannot indict a sitting president as DOJ. And if you look at that memo, it sort of poses these mind-bending law school hypotheticals. But really, the analysis is not legal per se. What does the law say? It's really practical. How would we run a country with a sitting president who's under indictment, maybe who's in jail? And so they conclude you cannot do this. And so that policy was reexamined after the Bill Clinton impeachment, and it was confirmed. And that policy has spared Donald Trump for sure many times over. But it's more than that, too. That's obviously a powerful protector of the president. The president also has the pardon power. Now, there's a long history of presidents abusing the pardon power. Bill Clinton pardoned his own half-brother. He pardoned a fugitive financier. You know, there's a long history of this. But boy, Donald Trump, I argue in the book, learned to weaponize the pardon power to protect himself, because he promised, dangled pardons to various of his associates who could have flipped on him. And sure enough, they stayed quiet or stopped cooperating. And sure enough, he bailed them all out with pardons: Paul Manafort, Michael Flynn, Roger Stone, and others. So I say Trump is particularly inventive, and I hesitate to use the word ingenious, in his deployment of the pardon power. So there are very special protections in place for the president that only one person in the entire country has.
It seems like we've been saying this since the 1930s, but I've heard it more recently than I've ever heard in my life, and that is, well, don't forget they got Al Capone on taxes. So
yeah,
what does that say about the system, that you can do all of this other stuff, but it's this particular rule that will quote unquote get you?
So I actually object to this line of thinking, and I talk about this in the book. I use that exact Al Capone analogy. I object to this line of thinking and approach to Donald Trump, which is somebody's got to nail this guy, and I don't care how, and I don't care what for. And I argue in the book, look, should Donald Trump have been prosecuted for January 6th? I believe absolutely, and it should have been done quite a while. It should have been indicted many months, arguably more than a year ago. I'm critical of prosecutors for taking way too long on that and in the process compromising their own ability to make the case. But I'm not on board with the notion that someone's got to nail this guy, and I don't care what for, and I don't care how. And I point out in the book, I'm critical of certain prosecutors who I think have targeted him overtly and politically. Look at the New York State Attorney General, Letitia James. She campaigned on a platform of elect me AG and I will nail the Trump. She said it over and over and over again. And I don't care if you love Donald Trump or hate him. I am not okay with that from a prosecutor. And if you are okay with that, then you also have to be just fine with someone running for attorney general of the state of Delaware on a premise of vote for me and I'll nail Hunter Biden. Vote for me and I'll nail Joe Biden. So I do think that prosecutors, maybe for their own political advantage, maybe to make headlines, maybe because they really mean it, are desperate to nail him. And as a result, I think have engaged in some bad practice and arguably even some abuses.
So if you are Donald Trump, what is the mindset of dropping your lawsuit against Letitia James?
Oh, it's a ridiculous lawsuit. I mean, I don't believe Letitia James acted properly and the way you would want a prosecutor to act in bringing this civil lawsuit. But there's no way Donald Trump was going to succeed on that lawsuit. Now, he can defend himself in the lawsuit brought by Letitia James by arguing that he's been targeted for political reasons. I'm sure he will make that argument. It's a tough argument to make, but look, it's a self-defeating tactic by Letitia James because she's handed him a basis to make this argument, this defense that she didn't have to hand him, but look, it benefited her politically, and that's the calculation she made.
So it seems as you read the book that you think to yourself, oh, well, look at all of this stuff. This is such a compelling case of how these people are untouchable. Well, so now that we've learned our lesson, we'll do something about it.
Sure. I mean, look, I'm not so naive as to think that our problems are all solved. I'm not so naive as to think that my book will solve all of these problems. But one of my big motivations for writing this book is to call out some of these inequities and to really take you inside the criminal world and the prosecutorial world to explain in specific detail how they work, not just make generalities, but to really flesh it out with often colorful stories. And my hope is that by bringing attention to these, I will push things ever so slightly in the direction of more equal application of the laws. I think that's a aspiration that we've held since the founding of this country, and we certainly have not achieved it, but I do hope that this moves us a step or two closer.
The name of the new book is Untouchable: How Powerful People Get Away With It. The book is published by Harper. Ellie Honig, thank you very much for being with us. A great pleasure to have you back on the program.
Joe, thanks so much. It was great talking to you. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much. Again, the name of the new book is Untouchable: How Powerful People Get Away With It, published by Harper. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.